Hello to everyone who has listened in on the podcast or is watching on our video podcast. Today we have two guests that I'm really excited to interview, and I also feel kind of quite privileged that I've got them on screen with us as well. We have Alison Vest and Kyra Condy, who are two of America's and or America and Canada's shining lights in terms of competition performance climbing. If you are involved with any kind of social media channel whatsoever, you will probably on a daily, if not weekly basis, see these two on your streams all the time doing the most, some of the most cool, amazing coordination sequences of gymnastic, dynamic style bouldering, and often involved with training as well. Some really impressive feats of strength that both of them have been doing. And you've kind of turned up on my social feeds a lot. And what I think is really interesting and why I wanted to get both Alison and Kyra onto this interview is that you've gone a long way to changing effectively the stereotype around female climbers, athletes, and performers in this sport. And I think it's a really interesting thing that you're doing. You're changing our culture, our stereotype around the training, the performance, and how we climb on the wall. You're both living in the same house together, and you're also seen as, interestingly, kind of like a proper duo partnership of power, I should call it. So there's some cool stuff I think we can talk about today in terms of both of your climbing together and what you get from that. So without further ado, can I please welcome you to this show and look forward to getting chatting to you?
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, psyched to chat.
I'm only going to refer to us as a partnership of power instead of training partners from now on.
We should put that in our like Instagram bios or something.
I know that it's in situations like this where someone just kind of makes up a phrase and you go, oh, I'll take that. I'll have that, please.
We are the wide boys.
Yeah, Tommy, you should know.
I get asked this a lot with Pete about where we kind of first met and how things kind of kicked off and where you saw the dynamic between you as climbing partners and have obviously ended up with a really good partnership now. How did that all happen originally with both of you?
Let's see. I definitely first became aware of Alison at Youth Pan Ams. Like Pan Am's in Chile, right? Yeah, where she like smashed and I had a terrible comp and I was like, who is this Canadian? And that was when I first knew who she was.
Yeah, and same for me, for sure, was that event. And then at the 2016 Open World Championships in Paris, I had lunch with the US team for some reason. Like I just had friends on the team, and then Kyra and her parents were going and touring Paris, like on the Champs-Élysées and like all the classic sites. And they just invited me for some reason, random Canadian to come with them. Yeah. So we were just running around Paris and we have like our life trajectories have similar overlap. Like we were both born in St. Paul, Minnesota in the US. I was actually born in the US. We started climbing at the same gym, like around the same time. We didn't know each other, obviously, when we were five or six or however old we were, but we did start climbing at the same gym and around the same time and from the same city. So there was all this overlap in terms of how we grew up and how we were raised. So we sort of bonded over that.
Yeah.
And then
yeah, Alison would be like, oh, I climbed at Vertical Endeavors. I was like, I started climbing at Vertical Endeavors. And then she's like, oh, I was born in Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota. Yeah. It just kept being like, everything was like in common.
And then I think I've started to realize lately that I think texting is like a skill. Like I think some people are good at it and some people aren't. And Kyra and I are both like, pretty good at it and on top of it. So
we're good texters. We respond quickly.
we're funny, I think. Anyway, so we sort of had like a long distance training partner situation. I mean, it really was like, I always felt like I was training by myself a lot and you'd do something that was like a PR or something you've never done before and feel like you had nobody to tell. And so I would just like, ended up being, I could just text Kyra and be like, oh, I PR'd on my one arm hang and it was sick. And this is what I did. And then she would be able to like respond and be like, that's so cool. So even though we weren't in the same place for most of our friendship, it was really cool to have like a hype person to be able to text when you do something cool.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I'd be like, I'm having a terrible session, and Allison would text me and be like, me too. Or like, kind of opposite. Like, oh, it feels so good today. It's like, sick, what'd you do? And just like really supportive from afar. So.
And do you feel like your climbing styles and the stuff that you're good at and not so good at have aligned over the years, so you see climbing in the same way, so your framework of how you view climbing and what it gives back to you is similar, or do you think there's no pattern there for either of you?
I think we originally thought we climbed in like the exact same style. Would you agree? And then like that was also kind of one of those things where I was like, oh, like you like big dynamic moves, like I like big dynamic moves, like things like that, like was one of those things we found in common. But I think as we've climbed together more, like actually in person, we found that we like both have really different strengths. Like mine is kind of contact strength, and Allison is super good on really tiny holds. And I mean, there's a bunch of other ones too.
Like I like weird body positioning, and Kyra's back is a single rod, so that's not so great for her.
Definitely not as good, for sure.
But I think like climbing philosophy wise, like I think that's one of the reasons that we get along really well. Like I think we both really value hard work. And training really hard, and we're both really motivated to just be improving and getting better, and I think we both expect a lot from ourselves. So I think on those sort of more philosophical climbing planes, we are really similar, which is I think one of the reasons we get along really well. Not necessarily like the technical aspects of climbing, I do think they're pretty different, but definitely in terms of our like mottos for climbing and training, they're definitely very similar.
Yeah, and like the amount of time we even spend at the gym, like we'll get in, we'll warm up kind of slow, and then get into the climbing session or train, do something, campusing, hangboarding, like working out, whatever. And like end up being at the gym for quite a long time. Like even just yesterday, I think we were at the gym from 11 until 3:30, just really long session. And you know, we could definitely get annoyed if somebody was taking a lot longer than the other person. And like, we both tend to just be there for like the whole time doing something.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's really interesting you say that about the kind of the work ethic part of things, because I think that if you're an individual that has a good work ethic, you end up having this radar for spotting others with it. And then if you suddenly realize that you have someone that you can maybe train with and have this, you know, beneficial partnership with that other person who has a very similar kind of work ethic, especially if your appetite for work ethic is really high and you can't find as many people to kind of match up with that, I think it's a really good thing, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's also kind of what's cool of what we got going in Salt Lake City right now, is there's a ton of people who are all like kind of have the same work ethic at the moment. And that's just been really rare to find. I think a lot of people in climbing have a lot of talent, and so get really far in climbing on talent, and then eventually end up finding that they need to put in the work later. And so right now, like, there's just a ton of climbers here who are just all putting in the work, and it's really cool to see.
Yeah. And what was your, both of your early climbing journeys like? Were you both kind of just ramping straight up that kind of, you know, V1 to V8 curve within just a couple of years? Or did you just slowly chip away at it? Would you consider yourself, you know, a hard worker versus talent? How does that both sit for both of you?
Yeah, I don't know. I grew up on a youth climbing team that was sort of notorious for like really hard training, sort of to the point where it was like kids either got injured and dropped out or they were really strong. Like it was just a very like old school way of training, like see if your body can handle it, and if it can't, then you have elbow tendonitis and sorry. Like that was like kind of the, and I mean, I was just lucky that I was one of the kids in that program that could handle it. And ended up surviving and doing pretty well. I think I grew up, I was always pretty good. I don't know if I was always like the best, which I think people in Canada forget, which is always funny. When I was on, I think when I won nationals for the first time, the MC in Canada asked me specifically, he was like, how many national championship titles is this for you? Like expecting there to be a bunch from youth. And I was like, it's the first one. Like, I don't know. Like I wasn't like winning, you know, I was doing well. I was on the podium or just off podium or whatever in youth, but I was never like winning nationals every year. So I think it took me into adulthood to, I think a lot of it was probably mental too. I always struggled with believing that I could do that.
I love how your cat.
So I mean, I think I was really lucky to grow up in have a program like that that sort of suited me, because like I said, and like Kyra and I bonded over, my default has always been just to work really hard and wanting to be pushed really hard. So I had a youth program that was like perfectly suited for that sort of side of me. But it took me until my adult years to really feel like I was able to put it all together.
Yeah. What about you, Kyra?
Yeah, so for me, I started climbing a little later than Allison. I was 11 when I started, or 10 or 11. And I was pretty talented right away. And I got into competitions right away because my team was about to go to the youth regional championships right when I started. So that's when I first became aware that there was competitions. And so I was able to go to the next regionals. It was lead climbing for that one. And then I got to go to the next bouldering regionals and made it to nationals my first year. Made finals, but got 11th. So, was naturally talented, but not naturally the best, I would say. I was on a youth team that was like pretty good, but they weren't super focused on on competitions in general. They kind of were focusing on, I'm not exactly sure what they were focusing on, honestly. I was kind of the person on the team who liked competing the best. And that actually kind of made me a little bit of an outsider, I think, on it for that reason. Because I was also pretty good at it. And so I actually ended up quitting my team when I was 14, and training by myself, basically from then until I moved to Salt Lake City when I was 23. So that's kind of been my trajectory. And then I think kind of like Allison said, I wasn't naturally the best. And then I got my back surgery and had to work really hard to get over that. And I think it's kind of that not always winning actually, I think, gives you that better work ethic. And I think that's something that we've bonded over as well. It's like, coming in second all the time or coming in third or fourth really pushes you and kind of lights that fire. Whereas if you just are always winning, I think it's just kind of comes to be expected almost. Not that that's just kind of coincidentally that happens, and I think having that fire from just always coming in not quite at the top is what has like given us our work ethic and brought us to where we are today.
I definitely agree. Like, I think if you're like on the podium, but you never are winning, it's just like, you feel like you're almost there and not quite there. And it sort of makes it easier for you to keep pushing for it and to want more out of it. And yeah, we definitely have a similar experience there for sure.
Kind of continuously keeps you basically in the journey rather than at the goal. And you always feel like you're in the process. And when you're in the process, I think that's where you're often the most resourceful, because you're thinking, oh, what can I do to improve? Where can I get an edge here? What do I need to change? And it keeps you in that mindset. Whereas I think when you get everything all the time, you're always like, cool, where's my praise? Where's my accolade? Yeah.
Exactly. I was talking to my sports psych about this, actually. I don't remember what it was exactly, but she mentioned basically how that's actually a true phenomenon that you see in sport is when people are winning all the time, it becomes expected. And then as soon as they don't win, then it's like really devastating because it becomes such a part of your self-image. Like, it's like, this is who I am. And so then as soon as that doesn't happen anymore, it is just really shattering to that like idea of self almost. And so like kind of for us, like the idea of self is like, I'm working hard and I keep seeing almost these results. And so it's like, it's a totally different mindset almost.
Yeah, that leads me to a question about, kind of self-image and sort of identity as well. And I'll frame it up with where it often sits for me and Pete is that I think we have sort of like this little hidden superpower in the fact that we very much see ourselves as just totally average kind of turbo punters who somehow kind of like just sneak our way up things, and we never take ourselves too seriously. And it works really well in a framing sense, because actually when everything goes wrong or we don't achieve stuff, we'll go, well, that was kind of expected. I mean, we're pretty rubbish at climbing. So it ends up being this superpower, because you always have very sort of relatively low expectations, and you frame up everything in a really positive way because you see your identity in that way. And do you have a similar thing with that at all?
So it's interesting. I think Kyra and I actually have relatively different outwardly facing, I guess, like brands as athletes, if you will. I think mine is really similar to that, actually. And I do things like that, like as coping mechanisms, almost as comps. Like I think when I compete in a comp, like I want to be like interacting with the crowd and like be kind of like, I don't know, goofy about it and sort of, I don't know, put on like an act, I guess, because it sort of feels like a coping mechanism. If I do badly in a final round, at least the crowd likes me. Like that's like the, like, at least they like my personality. Like that's the sort of like flip side of it. And I think my social media reflects that too. I definitely don't know if Kyra has that same approach.
I do not relate even a little bit, honestly. I actually think I have like a lot of confidence and I just don't, it doesn't really bother me if I don't like reach it, I guess. I think I'm trying to think of how to like explain it. The only things that really get me down in my climbing is when I find a move that hurts my back, because it feels like it's something that I have nothing I can do about. Basically, if I can't do a move, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'll just train harder on this thing and then I'll be able to do it eventually. It doesn't really bother me. But the things like with my back, it's like, it feels like something I don't really know how to deal with. It's kind of meta the way that I'll get better at it. It's, you know, trying moves that are hard for me in with my back, but it feels like something I can't stretch to make my back bend more because it's a bone, you know? So I think that's like the only time I really get down on myself in climbing. I'll be sad after a comp if it doesn't go well, but it doesn't like totally affect my image as like who I am. I think I'm pretty good at separating the two things as far as like my self-worth and my climbing performance.
And do you think that's something that you both got better at over time, almost like a practicing mechanism, or it's something that you have both been relatively good at from the start and you're just refining it? Because for a lot of people on the outside, I think they always look at professional athletes and go, you've just got it. It's unfair. Why haven't I got it? How can I get it? And they wonder about that process. And I don't know, for me personally, I've always felt like it's something that can be learned, but you've got to have like a little spark there in the first place. And you've got to have like positive feedback mechanisms that go on. But I don't know whether
you... Interesting. Like, I mean, I think it's interesting because we live together now, like we can reflect on that about each other. But I think, I mean, Kyra has every reason to be completely confident in herself and her climbing, obviously, like based on her resume and what she can do. So I think that totally makes sense. But outside of climbing, she also has like a blind confidence just on things that she has like no purpose being super confident about, you know, like we'll like buy a stick and poke tattoo kit and she'll be like, yeah, now we don't need instructions. I'm just going to go for it. And she'll just start like,
Allison's like watching the YouTube video. Like, and YouTube. I'm like, it's fine. I'll just try.
She's like, well, we can just try. I'm like, Kyra, look, but you have to sanitize. Look at it.
Same thing happens if I'm like leading hiking. I'm like, I have no idea where I'm going, but I'm at the front. So I'll just go. No, that's actually a good point. I think really that's my kind of superpower in climbing is kind of that blind confidence. And then the separation of self-worth and climbing ability. Because then if you don't do a move, it's not like I'm a bad person. It's like, oh, this move is hard. You know, like it's like a different way of framing it. Whereas I've definitely climbed with people. I don't know if Allison quite does this, but like there are definitely people who like can't do a move. And then it turns into like, I'm terrible and shit, you know? And I just don't relate to that one at all. The cats really want to be in part of the book this video.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because we're, you know, really good friends, but we are a lot very opposite in a lot of things. And I definitely do relate to that. I think I've always struggled to separate my self-worth and my climbing goals. I think when I don't achieve a climbing goal, it really is hard for me to not have that reflect badly on who I am, especially because I do center most of my life around climbing. And it is just sort of, I feel like sometimes all of my identity, which again, goes back to why I was saying I think so hard to have my actual personality show up on the internet and in interviews and in comps and stuff, because then it sort of makes me feel like people are paying attention for what I have to say and who I am in addition to what I'm doing in climbing. Yeah, so yeah, I think we are really opposite in that, in our sort of mindset. And living here, I mean, has been really good for me, and it has been good for me to sort of look at Kyra's mindset, and I do it as something that I definitely aspire to be better at and to be more towards her her mindset when she's competing, because it is very impressive, and I think it has been like really beneficial for her climbing and competing.
And would you say that with the climbing that you do together, in, you know, whether it's in sessions or training that you do, or time that you spend sort of socializing in the house as well, that the how does the sort of the competitive element that sort of sit between you of pushing each other in a positive way, and how do you find that balance in it? Because I've always found this is like really interesting element to, like, I think culturally a lot of people see competition between two individuals as like a winner, a loser thing. And it's very sort of polarized and split. But I actually think that there's two versions of competition. I think there's a negative, you know, more destructive version of competition where there's a winner and a loser. And then I think there's actually a version of competition where two people, or, you know, even more people, can be all pushed along and found in a better place. And I'm going to make an assumption that for you two, that competitive element is very positive and pushes you both further together. But how have you found that blend, if that is my assumption is correct? I mean, you could be fighting, you know, with each other the whole time. We just never know it.
All the time. It's constant chaos in this house.
Yeah.
I genuinely think we would still be friends if I competed for the US too. Like, I don't think that would really change it, but because I don't, like, that's a big element of, like, we're not trying to qualify for the same team, which just takes that stress out. Cause, like, I mean, as whether you're really good friends or not, like, there are limited spots on a national team. And there can be, I think, some more heightened competitiveness when you're trying to qualify for the same team. I don't know that that would be a deal breaker for us anyway, but it is nice that that's not the case. It does take that added element of necessary competitiveness sort of out of the friendship. I don't know. I think we're just good at
different things. Yeah, I feel like there's like, the way I see it is it'll be like, oh, Allison will go in and be like, I'm going to strength train today. And I'll be like, oh, maybe I should strength train. Allison's strength training. You know, like, it's kind of that type of competitiveness. Like, oh, like, she's doing it, I should do it too. Like, kind of that type of thing. So it is that more positive push, or like, I'll do 4x4s and Allison will be like, oh, I should maybe do 4x4s too. And it's kind of like that, which just pushes us to work harder. As far as like winners and losers on like boulders, like, we swap off who does a climb, you know, like pretty often. So I don't think, that's definitely not how I see it ever.
I also think like, it's something that is unique to climbing as a sport in general. Especially on the international stage and when people are training together, it's like, I think there's like a weird, like a very good sense of like, somebody's got to win. Like, it's not, we all, especially in the training center right now, like there's so many girls that are in there, especially that are just really strong and really motivated and training hard. And it's awesome because we're all motivating each other. But then when you do a round, like, somebody's got to win, and it might not always be you. So
climbing also has this kind of arbitrary aspect, you know, that is route setting, you know, like, that you're not competing on the campus board that's always the same. Or, I mean, speed climbing is obviously always the same. So that's kind of the only difference here. But I was talking to a track athlete and somebody asked us about like, how do you go into a competition? And she was like, I want to win. And I was like, oh, I want to go in and I want to make sure that my training is, you know, as trained as hard as I could. And then I'll be happy with my result as long as I feel like I put the right amount of effort in. I'll only be disappointed if I feel like I didn't work hard enough before this competition. And she was like, really? Because like, I just want to win. And I was like, I feel like actually in track, you kind of need that mentality, because you're literally standing next to all the people and you need to be like, I'm going to run faster than you, you know? And that's like how you win in that sport. Whereas in climbing, there's so many different things that could go wrong, that could not be your style. Like, it's just kind of an added aspect that we kind of all accept in climbing. And I think it takes away from the direct competitiveness, maybe.
Yeah. Totally. And I think like everybody wants to win. Like, I think it's fun, like, people having that mentality in climbing is great too, but I think it's an easier pill to swallow when somebody else beats you, because there is more variables than just like 100 meters straight in front of you and you're running as fast as you can.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I hadn't really kind of, totally viewed it in that way before.
Oh, sorry.
That's a really good way of looking at it, and probably a good thing, because it allows you to have a more positive experience from those situations where you don't have, you know, the win or the podium or whatever it might be.
My sports psych actually mentioned it as closed and open systems. So for example, speed climbing is a closed system. It's always the same. You can have a routine. You can approach it in the exact same way in practice as you can in comp. Same with gymnastics. You have your routine that you've practiced a million times and you go into competition and you do that routine to the same music, you know, so it's a closed system. Things like a rugby match or a soccer match is open because it can always be changing. There's so many moving parts and you have to be able to change the way you approach it while you're competing. And so climbing in bouldering and lead is open systems, whereas speed climbing is a closed system. And so it's really interesting to have both aspects in one sport because that's really rare.
Yeah, another good point. And I think it's quite a rare athlete as well that manages to reach the, you know, the pinnacle across those two. You know, we've seen now like a lot of people that are very, very good in speed and then will be relatively good in lead and boulder. And, you know, likewise, very, very good lead and boulder, but never quite achieve the same in speed. I guess in a way, how do you both feel about the sort of changes in the format and moving into sort of dual discipline? Do you think that's a good thing?
Oh, man. I think it's a good step as far as getting all three disciplines separate.
I think looking more, looking a little bit closer into the future for the 2020 Olympics, like I think it'll be really interesting to see how people have adapted to that sort of like Kyra was talking about closed system. Because I do think, I mean, Kyra and I've talked about it before. I think bouldering actually sort of in terms of physicality is more similar to speed just because of the power requirements. So I do think that now that there's been sort of time away from competition, you will get a lot of specialists in other disciplines like bouldering or lead who've had the time to like sit down and really focus on speed climbing. And you're going to get boulderers and lead climbers that are, I think, really fast at the Olympics. Like they just had the Japan Speed Cup and Tomoa went fast enough to win a World Cup in speed, like if the situation was right. So it's like you're going to get these people who've had the chance to train these closed systems and are going to sort of come out with, I think, faster speed times than you would have gotten had the Olympics actually gone ahead in 2020. So I think that'll be actually really interesting to see how that aspect of it shakes out.
Yeah, and as far as like the dual discipline, like the combined boulder lead, it has its own challenges. For example, scoring is just a mess. It's super hard because it's really hard to equally weight the two disciplines. You can't do the same rank system that you do for the three disciplines because so many ties happen because, you know, 1 and 6 is the same as 2 and 3. So, you know, there's so many ties. It's like a third of the time you'll get ties or something. Something crazy. So they've had to really come up with a way of scoring that's not perfected at all yet. So it is going to be really interesting to watch. I am interested to see if they're going to be able to equally weight the two disciplines. It comes down a lot to route setting. But basically the way to think about it, I think, is as a new discipline is kind of what Shauna Coxey was saying, actually. Instead of thinking it as a combined boulder lead, it's like this new discipline of sport climbing that's boulder lead. So. That's kind of how we'll have to look at 2024 Olympics, and then hopefully by 2028 we'll have all three. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think with any sport that enters into that Olympic cycle and evolution, it has to go through these changes, and it'll be, you know, part influenced by the organizations themselves. It'll be to do with how, you know, scoring systems work. How the training for them themselves develop as well, and whether you kind of get a backlog if it being too easy to, you know, essentially game the sport in a certain way with certain training methodology. I think that's just going to be the way for, you know, a good 10 years that the sport will evolve in its Olympic format. And yeah, in 10 years time, I think we'll probably be in quite a sort of solid place that everyone will know what's happening. But for now, all the Olympic athletes and Olympic hopefuls have got to deal with quite a, you know, constantly changing environment with it, which is interesting in itself, isn't it?
Definitely. It definitely adds an aspect of like mystery. I feel like 3 years ago, we couldn't have guessed the entire Olympic roster by any means.
Mm.
Definitely could have picked out some names, but, you know, I think you never would have. I mean, I don't think anybody expected the U.S. to get all four of our spots filled, and we did, you know, so, like, things like that, I think were really hard to predict with this format, and that kind of makes it really cool as well.
Yeah.
Just kind of who steps up to the challenge that we're given.
So tell me a bit about the Salt Lake City climbing scene and what's going on with it, because I travel to the Salt Lake pretty much every year, and I'm very aware of how good the scene is in Salt Lake. What is it that you think defines it, and why is it so progressive, and why do so many good climbers come out of that area?
Man, I was attracted to coming to Salt Lake kind of way before even USA Climbing moved their headquarters here. Like, I came and did a semester here in 2018 to do an internship. And I think for me, it's the proximity of a lot of climbing areas that I really enjoy. Like, you can go to a lot of different types of rock within kind of 2 hours. Whereas Colorado, you have a lot of stuff within half an hour, but it's all kind of similar, I guess. And so that's why I like Salt Lake kind of more than Boulder. It's also a little bit of a bigger city than Boulder, so it doesn't feel quite as much of a scene as Boulder does, because I feel like Boulder was kind of the hub, and now kind of Salt Lake has become that hub. I just had a lot of friends here too from youth climbing who all grew up on the Momentum team and had a really good like kind of team vibe, and I was really just always really liked and really positive and supportive, and I think I really craved that because I didn't have that on my team growing up. And so seeing that, I just always thought Salt Lake had this really great, like, supportive energy. And that's kind of what drew me here.
Yeah, I
think, like, even if you sort of extract Salt Lake from the outdoor rock around it, like, I think because there is so much climbing history there, like, there is just people everywhere that are so psyched on climbing. And there's so many people that are investing time and money into gyms and training and pushing the sport, and like, even when now the USA Climbing Training Center is here, which is great and amazing and is definitely a draw to come to Salt Lake, but even before that, like, there's just massive gyms with full fitness centers and bouldering areas and speed walls and lead walls, and so just the infrastructure here in terms of gyms is pretty amazing, especially because there's two different like big gym, you know, there's like Momentum and the Front. And I think they're competitive with each other, obviously, because they're in the same area, but it seems like it almost pushes them to add more things or make sure they're like keeping this up so that their clients are happy and don't go to the other gym. So because of that, like, you just end up with these really spectacular gyms here. And there is so much climbing history around and climbing psych that there's just tons of people who are strong and psyched and want to be better and want to push each other. And it creates that community that Kyra was talking about with the youth athletes that are here all the way into the adults.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we have a similar thing with whenever I've gone to Salt Lake and talked to climbers there, it feels, and it's the same to some degree as well with Boulder, but it feels like Sheffield in that there's this expectation amongst climbers, whether they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, that your scene is the scene which is going to push the sport forward. And there's like this expectation amongst it. So when people do knock on the door of like a new ability or a new type of move or a new standard, people go, yeah, well, that obviously happens here because it's Sheffield or it's Salt Lake. So people don't go, whoa, that was unbelievable. How on earth did you do 159 on a campus wall? They're like, well, it's Salt Lake. Everyone does 159 on a campus wall. You know, like, And it becomes this like self-perpetuating thing that then the community and all the climbers are saying and talking in that way. So then it pushes itself forward because there's just a mindset around it, around performance. And I think that Salt Lake is very cool for that. And all generations.
Yeah, and I think it's even felt with like getting new people into the sport. Like, I will leave the gym all the time and there'll be somebody who like very clearly was returning their rental shoes. Like, it's their first time in the gym and they're walking out the door and they're like, I'm going to climb V6 by the end of the year. And you're like, in a lot of places, like, they wouldn't even know what that is, let alone like have it as a goal. But when you go into these gyms and you're surrounded by people who are just like very goal oriented and just super passionate about climbing for all the greatness that it is, it's sort of contagious, and it's easy for it to just be like by osmosis to just be sucked into the sport. And so I think it is sort of a good place to have a business in climbing even too, because it's so easy to get people hooked on goal setting even in climbing and have them start coming back more and more often.
Yeah. I think there's two ways too that mentality can go. Like, it can get people to be like really psyched and like kind of what Allison said, but then it could also kind of come across as like elitist, and then people could be really intimidated. And I think Salt Lake does a really good job of like staying more towards the side that Allison said of like getting people psyched and getting people like motivated and wanting to try hard and train. I can't really speak from it, because I obviously came here while already being an elite athlete. But at least from what I've seen in the gyms and from talking to people who come to town, most people say that they feel really accepted in the community kind of right away. Like, even at the US team training center, which could be really clicky and really intense. Like, you know, people who come from out of town feel like right at home right away, which is like really cool, I think.
Yeah, I think that comes down to like the custodians of the sport, that if those well-known characters within an area are really friendly and really accessible to people at any grade, and they don't create that kind of clique and elitism, then again, it just perpetuates through the community, and people feel like it's accessible to be a good climber and everything. So, no. Okay, question about strength training. You're obviously both very strong and powerful climbers, and have, and I'll go on to the whole kind of coordination execution thing as well in a minute. But I think I'm going to say 99.9% of people who, when they watch your climbing videos, will go, how do I get that strong? Like, what is the secret sauce? What is Allison and Kyra doing that gets them so strong? What's going on? Tell me.
Oh man, honestly, people will be like, how do you get so good at canvassing? And I'm like, well, I've been canvassing for, what year is it, 2021? So like 6 years consistently, you know, like at least once a week. And I think that's really the secret sauce, is you gotta just stay at it. I also think changing up what you're doing is really important. Like, if I went in and I was like, I'm gonna try 158 once, I'm gonna try 147 once, and I'm gonna try to do doubles every time I go into the gym, you know, that's just not gonna do it. I've kind of switched and added exercises to my, you know, campusing just an easy one to talk about. I've switched and added exercises. I've tried new things when I see people post it on the internet. If I like it, I add it in. Sometimes I just mess around and campus boulders, you know, so switching up what you're doing to confuse your body and not get into that same kind of neurological engagement. You really want to confuse your muscles, basically. And that's, I think, where you really find a lot of improvement. Doing the same exact thing for 6 years doesn't find, you know, you don't do 159 that way. Maybe you do, but that doesn't work for me at least yet. But I do think this, like, changing things up and making things harder, making things easier, adding weight, taking weight off, all these things you can do to challenge yourself in different ways.
Yeah, I think it's a really, that's an interesting comment, because I do feel like I get, when we both get that a lot, people are like, oh, that's amazing. Like, how do you do that? But one I get often is just hanging, like on, like one arm hangs on an edge. People are just like mind blown by that, because like, if it's a Beastmaker hangboard or a tension hangboard or something, like, they're in gyms all over the place. So they're exactly relatable to what people watch a video of you doing it, and then they can go to their gym and be like, wow, that's crazy. Yeah. But people also just like put their hand on it and try to hang it and then go, I can't do that. That's crazy. Like, and sort of, like, I don't know if we need to do a better job of indicating how much we've worked on it on the internet. Like, maybe we do, but like, I couldn't hang the middle Beastmaker edge like 3 years ago either. And now I'm doing it with like weight added or whatever it is. But no, I don't know. I feel like people try it once and they're like, oh, I can't do that.
Well, yeah. So like, even like, that's actually a good story. Even Allison, so she can hang the beast, like the edge on the hangboard with like, I don't know, plus 60 pounds. But I remember when Allison came to visit me in Minnesota, and she was like, I was hanging with plus 10 pounds. And she was like, I can't do that at all. And I was like, try it. Just try it with 5 pounds. And she just hung it for like 10 seconds with 5 pounds. And she's like, oh. She just hadn't been making it harder. And then as soon as she started adding weight, as soon as you start making things harder, you kind of improve a lot quicker. And, you know, now Allison can hang like 40 more pounds than me on the hangboard. So maybe I should have kept my secret to myself. No, I'm just kidding.
I think, I do think with like hangboarding, it is like Kyra said, a lot of it for me has been like variety, like doing a hang with a certain amount of weight that you can hang for 10 seconds and then adding more. And even if it's only 2 or 3 seconds, trying, and then maybe going to a smaller edge and doing it without any weight. And then going like sort of doing something cyclical like that, where you have sort of all of the various levels, especially for me, because my left arm is like more than twice as strong as my right arm. Like, I think if I can hang
righty, man,
if I can hang 60 pounds on my left, it's like 30 on my right. So also varying the amount of weight is good, because then I can make sure my right arm is getting as worked as my left instead of just failing instantly.
Yeah, I mean, I get this all the time. What's the best way to hangboard? What's the best method? I'm like, there is no best method. How many times do I have to say this? I mean, I think I'll be doing this for another 10 years consistently, trying to do this whole thing. But it's because I think that people want these kind of magic bullets or the secret way to do things, or what's the hack for being able to do this thing, because ultimately that's what you would do if you didn't have work ethic. But if you've got work ethic, you don't need any of those things. It's just time and consistency and just building it in, and you know, having that 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. But and I think the social media does go some way to helping with this, but it's really hard to explain the journey in short kind of social media posts. Maybe if like we were all really good at taking photos or little video clips in 2005, 2010, 2000, you know, and like comparing.
I definitely have those. I have
some canvassing videos from like 2017.
Because that would explain the journey to people.
It's actually interesting.
Go for it. No, you go.
I even recently I posted a video on my story of me falling on a climb, and somebody, like a couple young girls, responded and were like, "Wow, it's you fall?" And I was like, "Of course I fall. Like most of the time I fall, actually. Like, but I'm only posting videos of obviously of me sending climbs, because I'm like, oh, this is me doing this climb. And then, but I expect that it's like just understood that I fell a bunch of times before I did it. But obviously, if you're only seeing me always sending climbs on my story, that's not what you see and then what you internalize. So I'm actually like recently decided I want to post more of that journey, just so that people don't get an unrealistic idea of what climbing is and what succeeding in climbing is, because it is this whole journey of falling a bunch and failing a bunch until you actually succeed.
Mm. Yeah, I was just going to add to like, I think what you said about people wanting like the hack is interesting, because I do feel like while social media can be good for showing like the side that Kyra just said, I think it also has become really trendy to use sort of terminology like that, like hack, or like the 5 secrets to hangboarding success, or like whatever the like big alluring title is. But for training, for the most part, I think like my mentality has always been, if it feels hard, then it's probably doing its job. Like, you know, there's all the theories on like, are you allowed to nestle the pinky, or is it what's your hand position supposed to be, or how much weight does it take off? Like, I'm like, this feels really hard to me, so I'm sure that I'm going to get better because I'm trying really hard. And sort of that's where, obviously, like, I like to track things. I like to know what I'm doing differently, whatever. But like, if I'm doing a training exercise and it feels really hard, then I usually am like, all right, great. That's like a good one, because it feels hard for me.
I actually apply that same thing to just boulders too, not just exercises. Like if I do a boulder and it feels hard, I'm like, oh, I'll do this again. And the next time I go into the gym, I try that same boulder, it still feels hard. Maybe I'm still sending it every time, but I'll do it every day until that boulder feels easy. And that's my method on the spray ball, which I don't see a ton of people do actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's like you can get a habit of where you have such a positive association with stuff feeling hard and getting the chance to try hard, but it then builds out over the years. Like I was training with Pete yesterday, and we got to the end of the session. We'd been training like 2 hours together, and we were both sat there just like really kind of like, oh, just like a bit bummed out about everything. And I turned on Pete and I just went, oh, it's so unsatisfying, because I just don't feel like I've had one really good try hard attempt. I've fallen off loads and I've essentially failed the whole session, which is fine. But I just wanted to get that feeling of just all out right at my limit. And I didn't get that magic feeling this session. So I feel dissatisfied. But if you compound that out, getting that access to that feeling for 5 years, 10 years, etc., you become a, you know, pretty good climber by doing that.
Definitely. And I actually, that's how I decide whether or not I'm satisfied with the competition even. Say I'm doing a lead competition and I fall off before I get to that really try hard grip state, you know, that's when I am sad about how I competed. I'm like, oh, I could have done better. But if I fall off and I like can't see because of how pumped I am, I'm like, okay, that's, you know, I did as best as I could. So like in Toulouse, for example, like where I qualified for 2020, I literally fell off the route and could not see for like a minute because I was so pumped. I was like, okay, well, if that wasn't enough to make me qualify, I gave it my all, you know, that I couldn't have done any better than that. So that's when I'm satisfied.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I do. I mean, I do think I, for me personally, like I've sort of had to learn to like almost let go of the expectation that climbing is ever going to feel like just perfect and floaty. Like I think it does for some people, at least when people talk about like sending a route or like doing the hard boulder, like, oh, I just like, I felt like I was floating and I was like flowing over the rock. And I have never felt like that. Like when I have done something hard, I am trying really hard and every move I'm like, I could fall here. Like it does not, I have never found that like state of like, this all feels easy. Like it just does not happen. Like I am trying hard all the time. So I don't know if that's like my mentality that just analyzes it different or whatnot, but I feel like sometimes people get sort of stuck and fall because it doesn't feel easy instead of like trying hard to get through the move.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I've had to come figure that out with my back even. So I'll get to these moves where I'm like, this is impossible. Like I can't bend my back. There's no way I can do this. And then I'll just let go. And then Josh, you know, our coach, will be like, maybe you should just try. And so then my next go, I kind of try to do it and I start doing the move and then jump off again. He's like, you didn't really try. And I'm like, okay. And so then I get on again and then finally actually like push through the like really uncomfortable bit. And then I actually do the move. So.
And do you, in those situations when you push through and you do it, do you like stick that in your back pocket and go, ah, I remember that. That was when I like tried and went through. And so then when you come back in another situation again, you get like a little flashback to the times when you push through on it and you use that going forward. Because I definitely do that. And I see that in the best athletes. They do this like micro recall thing from another situation. And then they use it again going forward. And they seem good at doing that.
Yeah, I actually have a note on my phone from like my personal sessions with Josh, where we identify some of those things and how to like maybe some of the little methods that I changed or things like that. I have them all written down in a note on my phone that I can look at to just internalize.
You're both really good at, or at least from my perception anyway, very good at the really dynamic coordination style, you know, cross between climbing, parkour, competition, bouldering, and a really complex style of climbing. And what I wanted to ask you about was that I think most climbers struggle with this style of climbing. It requires a lot of confidence. There's a lot of complexity in it. There's all sorts of mixture of technique and, you know, the physical side of climbing as well. And do you think that there is a pattern between the fact that you've both got very accomplished at that style of climbing and the fact that you also appear to be quite prepared to try kind of like mad off the wall challenges or just kind of like random things where you're constantly experimenting and trying to do things for your body, which again, require a level of coordination and confidence and stuff like that. Do you think it's just an approach thing? Like you have a mindset around this?
You can go first. That applies to you more, I think, than me.
I do
more stupid things off the wall, for sure. That is not inaccurate.
I tried it earlier, by the way.
I'm sorry?
I tried the yoga ball flip earlier.
Oh, yeah? Did it go well?
No. So scary.
I'm concussed now.
So scary.
I
refuse to try it.
There are a few things hopefully coming soon. One, you can pass the ball back and forth between two people. So one person does one of the rotations and it shoots the ball forward, and then the other person jumps on it and it shoots it back, so you can pass it back and forth. So I'm working on that one. The other one, you can actually do a double. You flip, and as you hit it, you grab the ball behind your back and throw it between your legs again, and then do a second one. That's been my like 4-year proj. The double ball.
She tries it every day.
Every single day. No, I don't. I would break my neck. But I think like having tried more and more of those things, does give me a better like body awareness. Like I think more and more people will send me challenges, and I'll be like, oh, this will be funny when I can't do this, and then I'll try it and be like, oh, I did it. Like
Allison also is just a really good all-around athlete. She played basketball and did track, and what else did you do? You did everything.
I did a lot.
Allison was a very like a big achiever in high school, whereas I always was only climbing. I found climbing when I was 11, and that became my only sport. So like, I think Allison's a super like good all-around athlete, and that I think definitely I see that help on those kind of coordinated moves. For me, I actually would not have said it was a strength of mine like a year ago. I think moving to Salt Lake and getting on those moves, I've been able to apply my strength that I have in other areas of climbing, like my contact strength and my dyno ability and stuff like that, to those moves. And I think that's how I've gotten good at them, is just practice in the last year. And now I would say that they are a strength. But I think a year ago, like my strength was definitely just straightforward. It's still a strength of mine, I guess, but like straightforward and like dynos, like just pull through dynos, because that's a lot of arm power.
I do think, tying it back to what you were just saying though, like I think something that's been important to train in terms of comp style, like hard coordination boulders, has been that try hard aspect. Like I feel like I just wasn't good at being able to try hard in those situations. Like it just sort of felt like you either executed it perfectly and it worked, or you didn't do it. But there definitely is an aspect of like being able to try hard to compensate for a slight miscalculation. Like if it's a run and jump, like a slight miscalculation of the run and jump, if you try hard to stick the holds, even if you aren't on them perfectly, like you can still sort of get away with it. But I definitely think being able to sort of engage that try hard aspect is something that has been shockingly trainable on coordination moves.
Also, the hack is that it's all in your hips. That's the hack on that one.
You can title this podcast Kyra Condie's hack to competition climbing.
The five tips and tricks.
To coordination moves
is it's all in your hips.
Oh, you've said it now, Kyra. There's no going back on this.
Oh, no. Everybody will watch it now.
Quick copyright.
You did say something really interesting there, actually, Allison. You said, if I fail, it'll be funny. And this really stuck out to me, because I hear a lot of people go, if I fail, that'll be scary. Or if I fail, I'm going to get hurt. But the first thing you said was, if I try something and I fail, it'll be funny. And
well, this is honestly, like, we've had all these girls in the training center, and they're all pretty psyched on social media, like on growing their pages and posting a lot. And so when somebody takes like a bad fault, which happens frequently, the first question is who was filming. Like it's not,
get a video of that?
Are you okay? Like that looked bad. Are you going to try again? It's instantly, was somebody filming that? Cause it's like a funny fall and they want to be able to post that on their story or whatever. So I think that's another way that social media has been a good tool, is because people are like either motivated to send it secretly for Instagram, or they fall and that's also entertaining for Instagram.
Yeah, yesterday I was doing a dyno at the gym and I was like, Josh, am I gonna face plan if I do this? And he goes, I don't know, but I'll film. It's like, great, okay.
Yeah, you always walk away with something good out of it, don't you? Whatever way, if you do it, you land it, you're like, kudos. Don't Instagram.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to ask you this question as well. You both are really active on social media, and I really like the way that you do your pages and the stuff that you do within your content. And I think it comes across, even though you're both really accomplished athletes, it comes across with a real just kind of like accessibility and humility in it. It's not like a, hey, look at me, I'm just the most awesome ever. Like just total like pose down. It's not at all like that.
That's good.
I mean, I think it's something that's really important to me, is to try to display my authentic self to the internet. I try and come across that way in, you know, interviews and stuff like that as well. I guess, yeah, I just like want to be myself. I don't try to like put on a persona a lot of times. I think all the time, I guess. But so I'm glad it comes off that way, because that is very much so me, I guess, on the internet. So
it does. I mean, if you really break it down to in a practical sense, like Instagram is a good part of our jobs, being on social media, and it makes it really easy. If you're just are who you are on the internet, it makes it a lot easier to be creating posts and content in terms of like being an athlete, if you are authentic to yourself, because then it just doesn't feel like as stressful or as much of a job if you're just posting who you are on your Instagram page.
So do you feel though that there's a lack of I don't want to call it training, but there's a lack of awareness for younger generations coming through of understanding how to actually do that well and do it for the good of yourselves, because it's a really interesting space, because you, especially if you have a large account, you're in front of a lot of people and you have a lot of interactions with people that have no idea who they are, and we don't get training in school. We don't have, you know, there's no class in school that's called social media. There's no government guidelines to tell us how to do this stuff, but it's a quite a big impact feedback in our lives. And you've done it well, obviously, like, I guess through, you know, learning and a degree of that sort of natural ability on it. But I have to say, I feel sometimes a bit concerned with some of the younger generation coming through with it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a double-edged sword there. I feel like on one hand, you're right. Like there is this younger generation that doesn't have people to teach them exactly how to use social media. I mean, I feel like we both learn through trial and error what people like and don't like and how to be authentic and how to sort of put our authentic selves on the internet, obviously to an extent. But I do feel like on the other hand, like there's this new generation who's just grown up with social media. Like I didn't have Instagram until I graduated high school. And now there's this new generation that has grown up with it. And I do feel like that will almost make them understand it more because they've grown up seeing what they like and what they don't like and who they relate to on the internet and who they don't relate to and what they like, I guess, like the content that they like the best and what comes across the best way. So I do feel like there's that sort of side of it too, is having grown up in it and being more used to it. Like, I mean, ask like my younger cousins and some of the younger girls all the time about, like, you know, Kyra will come into the gym and be like, so there's this TikTok thing. There's this trend. What does this mean?
I heard Gen Z canceled skinny jeans. What does this mean? You know, well, because we're tail end millennial. Like people call us like the 1995 to 1997 like block, because she's about 95, I'm 96. Like zillennials or something, because it's like we don't really fit in entirely with either group. I have an older brother, so I like definitely feel more like a millennial. But yeah, so it's just really interesting because like we were kind of tail end of the social media, or very, very, very beginning of the social media generation, I feel like.
I do think it'll be impossible to predict what will happen with this generation that has been completely immersed in social media their whole lives, just because we've never seen it before.
I mean, it could give a super unrealistic expectation to like everything, honestly, because like we were saying, even things I post, you know, I don't always post my fail videos, but that's most of the things that I'm doing. You know, I post the ones where I'm succeeding. And so, you know, if I grew up only watching people succeed and be successful and, you know, look amazing and be in these exotic places, I can't imagine what that would do for my psyche. So I'm actually quite glad that, you know,
we missed that,
like didn't have Snapchat in middle school, you know, like, yeah. For real.
Yeah, but for, you know, for sure, TikTok for the win. We do know that, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a TikTok. We understand TikTok to some extent.
Yeah, even I'm on TikTok. I love it. and my kids are a lot better at it than me as well, for sure.
We're still trying to understand. We daily are like, are we supposed to, what is this trend? What do we, who, how do we film this? What does this button do?
Alison, I know you've got to go off for a training session in a second, so I don't want to overrun on this, but I want to just ask you Both one last question before I let you get on with your days, and I know they're typically filled with training as well, but can you both tell me a little bit about what you've got kind of planned for this coming year? I know for Kyra, you've got the Olympics. How's that working out? And I know, like, with COVID and there's like no traveling, it's just been an absolute nightmare last year, but you know, what have you got planned for this year coming up?
Yeah, let's see. Utah actually is really ahead of schedule on the vaccine, which is kind of awesome. It's supposed to open up to the general public on April 1st. So that's, you know, kind of nice to have that on the horizon. I'm actually volunteering at a vaccination clinic too, so I'll be able to get it this next week. So that's like really exciting, especially because, you know, traveling is kind of about to start. And definitely want to feel responsible while traveling. I think we do have an exemption to be able to compete in Meiringen without quarantining for too long, like maybe only a couple of days with a negative COVID test. So ideally, we're going to be able to go and do some of the World Cups. There's obviously two World Cups here in Salt Lake. So we won't even have to travel for those, which is really nice. But we're really focusing on those, trying to get at least one World Cup in of each discipline before the Olympics. So there's a bouldering World Cup.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm still here. Yeah. Thanks, Brendan. We'll definitely have to cut that one out. that was the site manager coming over.
Oh, nice. No, okay, yeah, I can just restart that bit then.
Yeah, carry on and I'll get time to do that. In fact, let me just make a note on the time lapse. So that was 17. Okay, yeah, carry on. Or restart that little bit there.
Yeah, so I mean, ideally, we're going to be able to go and do a World Cup of each discipline before the Olympics. We'd like to be able to do a speed World Cup, a lead World Cup, and a bouldering World Cup. And so that's kind of our goal, is to be able to do at least one of each. And then obviously the Olympics, but trying to peak for the Olympics. So we'll see how those World Cups go, because obviously they're going to be mid training cycle. So
yeah, which is always an interesting blend.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so Canada has announced they're not sending any athletes to Meiringen. So I definitely won't be there. I'm hoping that even if they don't decide to send a full team to Salt Lake, that I maybe could be the exception and compete because I live here, which seems logical, but we'll see. I mean, it just depends on what the rules and restrictions are. Everything for us is just really up in the air. So I think for me, as the weather gets nicer, I'll try to get outside climbing more, because that's a goals I can work on without comps in the near future. So I'm excited about that. And then when time comes, then they decide we can go to a World Cup, then that'll be great too.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a huge amount of, it's essentially general uncertainty with any kind of planning. And I think it is, I mean, from my perspective, the worst possible year for being a pro athlete, basically, because normally you plan all your stuff out and you know what you're doing, you know how you're training, you know where you're going to perform, roughly how what stuff works out. And now it just constantly feels like they're changing things on you all the time. It's really frustrating.
Definitely. I had some minutes after that, but I lost it. Never mind.
I'm sure it was really good.
It's probably a really good thing.
I'll want to ask where everyone can find your social media channels, whether you have any websites. List me them out, because you're all over the place. I know. TikTok, Facebook, Instagram.
Our joint TikTok is Climbing Roommates.
Climbing Roommates. Okay, yep.
And then my Instagram, Kyra_Connie. Allison's is.
Mine is just Alcibest. I wasn't sure if there was a dot in there or something. There's not.
And then I actually have a website too. It's just KyraConnie.com. So.
Okay, cool. We'll put the links all down below.
You can find my Wikipedia page off of Kyra's Wikipedia page, because they're linked together.
Yeah, exactly. We had a connection.
That's true. Wikipedia
pages and a lady who did that for us.
Hang on a second though, Allison. You're saying that you haven't got your own individual Wikipedia page. You can only...
No, I do, but I feel like people mostly just find it
for Kyra. For a little while though, because it takes a while for the Wikipedia page to come to the top of Google. Like when you Google Allison Best, like other things were coming up. The only way we could get to hers, because we couldn't find it, was if we clicked on the link in mine. So then we just did that a bunch so that hers came up further on Google. So.
Smart
tactics.
Always working together. I like it.
You know it.
Well, sweet. Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Really nice to chat to you both. And I'm sure we'll chat again very soon.
Definitely. Thanks for having us.